Thank you very much, Jenny, and it's really a great pleasure to be here and to join in this conference. And I'm also a bit of a fleeting guest, but I do hope that if you have any questions that you don't manage to have addressed this afternoon, then please do get in contact with me. And I always very much enjoy hearing Chris talk, and then, of course, it's now my responsibility to bring you completely back down to earth and talk about some terrestrial ecology for a while. So I'm Helen Roy. I'm based in the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology, which is a NERC-funded research institute. And within the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology, I lead the zoology side of things within a group called the Biological Record Centre. And I'll explain a little bit more about the Biological Record Centre as I go through and how we work towards openness and rigour with our very large-scale, long-term data sets that we hold that are collated by volunteers. So I've got a lot of slides, but I'm hopefully just going to give you lots of sound bites and hopefully some good pictures too and some observations. But I just wanted to begin by defining citizen science and what I'm meaning by citizen science. And I'm very much biodiversity focused and looking at volunteer collection of biodiversity and environmental data, which contributes to expanding our knowledge of the natural environment. And this is including the biological recording that I've already mentioned to you and interpretation of environmental observations. It's a very dense slide, and I'm not going to go through all of it in detail. If you're interested in different approaches to citizen science, there was a good paper out by Bonnie in 2009 where she went through the different types of projects, and we've already heard about the range of projects and the range of approaches that people can take with citizen science, and she just explains this in a little bit more detail. We would add another, she recognized three types and three approaches. We would add the volunteers working together on all of the stages of the project without the involvement necessarily of professional scientists. And this is a model that's characteristic very much of local biodiversity atlas projects, which have been going on for centuries and centuries within the United Kingdom. So one of the things I just wanted to mention to you first was that at the end of last year, I published a review that was commissioned by the UK Environmental Observation Framework, where I worked with a partner at the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology and also partners at the Natural History Museum. And we reviewed hundreds and hundreds of different citizen science projects, including some of the ones that Chris has already mentioned today. And we took out lots of different attributes from these different projects and then ran them through a multifactorial analysis, looking at aspects such as what type of project they were, what sort of field of research were they in, and various other aspects of that project. Did they involve school children, et cetera? Is there evidence of data quality, things like this. And we were really excited. We expected that we were going to see these great clustering of different project types that we would sort of have our own sort of universe feel to. And this is very much what we got. This is actually, maybe it is like a spiral universe or something. I don't know. Maybe that's what we got and we've missed it. Yeah, quite. So if anyone wants to make something from that, then absolutely wonderful. So it's the landscape of citizen science. And at first we sort of felt this sense of, oh, and then we thought, well, quite, that's exactly what citizen science is like. It's hugely diverse, and there's projects in all different directions of being taken in by different people doing different things. And actually, that's a celebration of citizen science, that huge diversity and that huge range of approaches. But of course, that wasn't going to be enough to report back to the people who commissioned this project, and so we needed to look a little bit more detail at this picture. And so we tried to kind of look at these different axes and how they were best explained. And the way in which they seem to be best explained is looking at the amount of investment that needs to go into a project and the scientific sampling and whether it's mass participation and what kind of data is being collected. Is it very straightforward observations, or is it requiring somebody taking many, many more measurements, both climatic variables, for instance, alongside some biological observations? And if you're interested in that, then there is the full report is available. And we, from this, produced a sort of glossy guide to citizen science. And I've left some of the copies of that down on the reception desk. And if you want any more information, then please do get in contact with me. But I'm going to focus very much on the biological recording within this landscape of citizen science and what we're doing with respect to rigor and openness. So I appreciate that we have a very diverse audience, and I hope there are some zoologists, biologists in the audience as well. This is my first time, I think, ever in a physics building, so I'm feeling quite excited to be here. So what is biological recording, and who are our citizen scientists? Well, biological recording has a hugely long history. Back in the 1600s, a gentleman called John Ray was mapping all of the plants in Cambridgeshire, and very recently there's been a translation of his Latin text, and it's just absolutely fantastic the work that he was doing as a citizen scientist all those hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And in many ways, biological recording hasn't changed at all. I grew up on the Isle of Wight as a biological recorder, and I definitely think there were reminiscent times of the John Ray times back in the 1600s, I'm sure. And our biological recorders haven't changed hugely either. They're people who are going out making observations. They're interested people. And they might be, for example, these people here, just out in a group, just observing some species or other, which hopefully they'll make into a biological record by saying where they found it, when they found it, what it was, and who they were. But more recently as well, there's been a push for getting school children involved. But when I say this to my botanical colleagues, they say, well, we've already always been pushing to get younger people involved. We're a little bit different perhaps sometimes in the zoology world, I don't know. But our citizen scientists can also be school children. They can also be the extreme and passionate experts, such as this is one of my friends who goes out recording ladybirds, and this is her looking for quite a rare species of ladybird. So they come in many, many different guises. And we have about 80 million biological records available and open access for everybody to use. They're shared through the National Biodiversity Network Gateway, and they present a fantastic opportunity for people to address some of the really big questions, particularly in relation to some of the threats that are posed on the environment at the moment: climate change, the arrival of alien species, habitat destruction. We can use these biological records to look at species distributions and attribute changes over time, particularly in relation to some of these big environmental drivers of change. Do these records actually allow us to do that? Well, they certainly do provide us with a fantastic opportunity. There's no doubt that in Britain we're in a hugely fantastic position of having this really rich source of biological data, which is undoubtedly the envy of the world. That we are a peculiar nation, I think, in many ways, probably. But in our passion for gathering these biological observations, we're certainly peculiar. And there aren't the same data sets across all of the range of taxa. Birds get well covered all the way around the world. But we have people here recording the small soil invertebrates, little calembola, fleas, lots of different groups. So, for example, there are about 80 different zoological recording schemes and societies that I represent within the Biological Record Centre. So we have these huge opportunities of this fantastic data sets. And this map, which you probably can't see too clearly, shows we would never have known that this little orange ladybird, a mildew-feeding ladybird, went through. It was thought to be an ancient woodland specialist. And just in the last couple of decades, has gone under a massive range expansion, as is shown by these red dots. We wouldn't have known that if people hadn't been out on the ground tracking its spread. But there are also lots of challenges with this data. So here we've got the seven-spot ladybird, and just in the middle, or down to the bottom, is an alien, the harlequin ladybird that I'll talk about a little bit in a while. And this seven-spot ladybird, well, we should find it all over the country. It should be everywhere. And you can see there's lots and lots of gaps in that map. So that presents us with a challenge that we have uneven coverage of the recording that's going across the country. And also, just looking, I'm going to show you a few graphs, and I won't go into them in much detail, but we can always go back to them, or I can talk through them at a later stage over coffee or something. But recording intensity varies among taxa, so perhaps it's not surprising, although I'm quite envious, not being a butterfly ecologist myself, I've done a little bit of work on butterflies, but not much. They get a huge amount of attention, lots of people out recording butterflies. So my passion is ladybirds, and I'm the volunteer scheme organiser for the UK Ladybird Survey, so I do that in my own time. And so ladybirds fall within the Coleoptera, within the beetles, and we're disappointingly perhaps lacking enthusiasm within the world of Coleoptera as far as recording intensity is concerned. But if we want to do a cross-taxa analysis, look at a range of different taxonomic groups, we're a little bit stumbling with the difference between the recording intensity of those different groups. The recording intensity has increased over time, so I won't go through all of these different groups again, but we can see that just in recent decades, there's been a trend of increase in recording intensities for many groups. Some groups are going down a little bit. I don't know what's the myriapods or the woodlice and centipedes, and they seem to be the purple line seems to be having a bit of time, but we're addressing that. We've got a new website. You can go and have a look at the millipede and woodlice website and find out more. We have a similar profile of our recording pattern that Chris showed you with his beautiful diagram with lots of coloured squares. Well, our diagram is less exciting, but essentially most records come from a very few recorders. We can see that as a challenge, but we can also see that as hugely beneficial, because if we get those recorders recording even more, those few recorders, well, we'll get even more. So, you know, we can look at different parts of that graph and look for the ways to make the most of that. Another problem we have, so if you imagine that for all of these groups, for the ladybirds, for example, there's 47 species of ladybirds within Britain. It's very rare that somebody goes out with the intention of recording all 47 of those ladybirds. Well, they wouldn't find them all in one site anyway. But if we knew that they were actually looking for all 47, then that would give us a fantastic extra bit of information for our database. But we don't know that. Most people are just going to go and make one quick observation of a seven-spot ladybird, and that's it. We'll never know whether they were looking for the others or not. They probably weren't. We also have problems in spatial patterns of recording behaviour. So we can see the hotspots of where people recording grasshoppers and crickets live by the map of the records that come in. So we can see that this biological recorder here, for instance, doesn't record very far away from this little location there. But all of those problems that I've sort of skirted over, and we have answers, is what I want to say excitingly. So with the new modelling techniques we can use, with new mixed effect models, with a variety of other different approaches, we can use this data. And in terms of the rigour, well, it's fantastically rigorous in terms of the quality of the observation. So our biological recorders in this country, the people who are going out recording bees, for instance, they know their bees. So we know that when they say it's this particular bee, it is that particular bee. It's the other problems that we have to overcome. And so we've been doing some work, and particularly a colleague of mine, Nick Isaac, to look at how we can use different analysis techniques to detect change within these data sets, despite the fact that they have lots of confounding problems within them with respect to spatial spread, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not going to go through all of this in any detail. It's just to really say that we do have techniques for using that data, and mixed effect models are a very, very good way to go. And if anybody wants any more information on these, I'm very happy to provide it. Another way in which we're ensuring quality and ensuring the flow of records and making things a lot easier for people to get involved is by having software that makes recording very, very easy. But we do have this diverse audience. I remember when we published the Flea Atlas, and I went down to see 80-year-old Bob George, who was the Flea Recording Scheme organizer, and I knew he didn't have a computer, so I took down the data to show him how it's on the National Biodiversity Network Gateway, and it was open for everyone to see his flea data now. And I was so excited, and I went down to his house, and I said, I've got your data here on the computer to show you. And he said, well, you can if you want, but I'll just make us a cup of tea. And he wasn't interested at all in the fact that the whole world was sharing his data. He was happy that they were, but didn't really want to see it. It meant nothing to him. He just wanted to look at the fleas. But for some people, they do want to look at their data, and iRecord gives them that opportunity to do that and helps us with data flow. And we have expert verifiers behind the system checking out photos and checking out of area records, and we have various automated rule sets within there as well. We also provide a rich reporting mechanism so that people can get their data back very easily and see how it maps against other people's systems. So I would say that we are in a very, very good position in the biological recording world. We can describe change, we can attribute change, and we can use that change for a variety of different end uses, whether it be for policymakers to look at biodiversity indicators, for instance, which are all very important as we move towards Biodiversity 2020 and the various targets that we're trying to meet with respect to biodiversity. I just very, very quickly just going to focus on the ladybird survey, and it will be very quick because as soon as I get talking about ladybirds, it could be very long, but I will be disciplined. And the UK ladybird survey fits in this top position within that big landscape that I showed you. We have quite a high investment in terms of resources that we provide and things, but it is a mass participation project. We have a website that we hope is good and rich in information. We link with this iRecord system, and we have an iRecord survey form, but I also want to gather data. I'm interested in evolutionary ecology as well, so I want to gather data on colour forms of ladybirds as well, so we add that to our recording form. And we get fascinating records sent to us, like this little ladybird here, Stathoris punctillum. If you were to draw a dot on the paper in front of you, that's about the size of Stathoris punctillum. I get excited just talking about it. And so somebody who found this, it's just absolutely remarkable that somebody actually does manage to find this, and this comes through on our survey website, and that just, well, I think, fantastic. And We are also, we've worked a lot with the media, we've worked a lot with the BBC, and we have lots of resources available for children as a consequence of that. I'm on Twitter with the Ladybirds. The Ladybirds are the charismatic partner in this. I just about only tweet about Ladybirds, but somehow 1,500 people are pleased to hear about Ladybirds, or maybe they've strayed onto it by accident, but they do seem to stay. And we get fantastic records through Twitter, and this is one that came through last summer. We're just about next week, we'll be launching a smartphone app, and I can show you the prototype. I'm very excited about that. That's all looking fantastic. But one of the things that I'd like to say with respect to the rigor and the openness is that we can have all the technology in the world and we can engage this, our crowd using the technology, but we still need that face-to-face contact. You still need that passion, that enthusiasm, and going out and talking to people and engaging the community. And that's certainly been an extremely important part of getting the contributions to the Ladybird survey and engaging the media. We're really excited when Ladybirds took over the front page of the Times. And this data is valuable and it is useful. I had a review back from on one of my peer-reviewed publications last week where this one reviewer said, excellent, lovely manuscript, it was great. Another one said, how can we trust this data? Not even reading any further. And it's just so frustratingly narrow-minded, I will say it, to not consider all the things that are going on in terms of ensuring the rigor and ensuring that the data is fit for purpose. And this is just one example whereby we've used this ladybird data that's been coming in, and I mentioned this alien harlequin ladybird. It arrived in 2004. It's a voracious predator. It threatens the other ladybirds. We were able to use all of these tens and tens of thousands. We had 40,000 records of the harlequin ladybird since, which I know doesn't compare to the kind of uses that Chris talks about, but in the ladybird world, that's big numbers, and recording harlequin ladybirds, and also recording the native ladybirds. So we were able to show, for instance, very depressingly, that this is a little two-spot ladybird, a common and widespread species. And we were able to use Belgian data and British data. We just look at the British data, the dashed line shows the decline after the arrival of the harlequin ladybird. And we were able to use these modelling techniques that I mentioned to you to use this data for some good, robust science, and publish that at the end of the year. And I find it fantastically satisfying that that's based on volunteer data. We're using that system. We've produced an alert system for non-native species now for DEFRA, using the same sort of approach to getting people involved in recording species. And we're looking out for the Asian hornet and the fearful, the fierce killer shrimp, which is pictured here. So biological recording for the 21st century, we have the tools to model diversity change using these unstructured biological records. We've got to keep getting the records coming in, and we've got to keep motivating people to supply their data and supply their records, just as they have been doing for centuries and centuries. And there's ways in which we can definitely be smarter about that data collection. And we're only just beginning to exploit this huge resource of 80 million records that are open to all of you to get involved with and use. And I can assure you they are rigorous. And we can use them in so many different ways to answer so many of the very important questions that we have within the biodiversity world today. So that's it from me. Thank you very much.